Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Welcome to another edition of the Apparatus Architects Podcast with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. We'd like to open up by once again thanking very much our sponsor, Task Force Tips, for sponsoring the Apparatus Architect series on Firehouse Podcast. And over the course of the last couple of weeks, Brother Mike, there's been a lot of activity going on, some good and some not so good stuff, particularly with respect to accidents. So before we let Mike run down that, here's what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to go over some little bit of industry news and some incidents and apparatus, significant apparatus accidents that have occurred since we last recorded a podcast. We're going to talk a little bit today about apparatus trends and are they good or bad. And this might be an opportunity for Mike and Tom to play good cop, bad cop here, but we're going to talk about three or four different trends that both of us have kind of observed over the period of the last couple of years and try to see if we can come to arrive at consensus here. As they say, we might get Brother Mike to come across the aisle to my side, but we'll see what happens there. Then we're going to be talking about, does your department have an apparatus replacement program, something that we've been quite surprised to see. There's some good-sized organizations that don't really have anything down on paper or even in somebody's mind as to what they're going to do when it comes time to replace their apparatus. So starting off, Brother Mike, what's been going on here with apparatus accidents lately? We're coming in, here we are on the early part of June, wrapping up the first half of the year. Are we doing any better getting behind the wheel of our apparatus, or how are things looking out there?
No, unfortunately not, Tom. Things are as bad, if not worse, than they've been. One of the things that we'd like to highlight today's announcements with is as we enter into the parade season where the brothers go out and show their apparatus off and strut their stuff, just want to remind everybody just to stay off the trucks when they're in motion. You must be seated and belted at all times, and parades are no different. We cannot have people on the outside of the apparatus during parade season. And then particularly if you are going to imbibe at all, please have somebody else drive and don't drink and drive. Just a couple reminders as we head into the parade season and muster season of the summertime. Probably one of the most significant things that happened during the course of the month since we were on the air last was not an apparatus accident, but rather an aerial failure. And it caused the death of a deputy chief in the western part of Pennsylvania when a 75-foot straight stick quint with a pinnable waterway, the pinnable waterway was ejected as it was not pinned properly or not pinned at all. When the waterway was charged, waterway assembly and one length of the waterway was actually ejected off of the truck and hit the deputy chief in the chest, almost killing him instantly. And so we can't urge our listeners enough to please make sure that when you are operating these pieces of equipment that you properly pin your waterways. I was doing a class yesterday in Oxford, Pennsylvania, for the Union Fire Company, and they were actually telling me that they had pinned their waterway in two different pinholes, and actually torque the waterway, and bend it kind of in a U. And then when we have an event like this where somebody is killed and it's noteworthy, then we start finding out about all the other events that have occurred over time where nobody's gotten hurt and they didn't seem noteworthy. I was led to believe that as many as a dozen waterways were damaged in some fashion or another in the Detroit Fire Department. In Fairfax City, Virginia, there was another waterway failure after the one in western Pennsylvania that was noted. And then in another kind of odd twist with aerial ladders, an Indiana firefighter, his foot was crushed in an aerial ladder during a public demo on the 5th of May when somebody retracted the ladder while a firefighter was on it, which, of course, is a big no-no to do as well. So we need to exercise more care in and around the aerial equipment, and certainly we can't urge you enough to make sure that the waterways on pinnable waterways are pinned in place before water is started and defensive operations commence.
Yeah,
moving
Mike,
on now.
Point,
go ahead, Tom.
Mike, it was interesting that that very tragic incident that happened down in Pennsylvania, as you mentioned, that it didn't take too long. It was probably just about a month. I think it was May 8th that NIOSH came out with their advisory, safety advisory, alerting fire departments about this particular issue. And to go to your point where you said that, you know, we have one tragic incident and then other, you know, other people tend to come out of the woodwork and tell you about issues or problems that they have. Just as a sidebar, if you look at the, you know, waterways, fixed waterways on apparatus have been around for quite some period of time. For some of our and I say this tongue-in-cheek, our younger listeners, that might be the only aerial device that you've ever known that had a fixed waterway as compared to some of the early installations that people did where the waterway was not pinnable and was fixed in the outer fly position, which you know, gave you a little bit of tactical advantage if you were in a defensive mode. But I think, Mike, you've seen in many cases with your instructions of going out to do aerial ladder trainings, when people had the early versions of those fixed waterways and had the waterway all the way out underneath the outer fly section, it really limited not only what you could do with the apparatus, but also severely limited the ability for firefighters to dismount or to climb back on the aerial. And I think it's one of those things, if you're not sure what it's supposed to be like or how it's supposed to operate, you break out, number one, you break out the owner's manual. Number two, if you can't find that or you're not sure, then it's certainly incumbent upon you as the department or the training officer or the apparatus officer, contact the people that built your apparatus, and if you're unsure what it's supposed to do or how it's supposed to operate, get trained on that. Mike, you'd like to comment about some of those observations?
Well, that's absolutely correct. We were actually doing a training class at a training academy one time, and we had one of those trucks that had a fixed waterway, and it took two firefighters 5 minutes to ladder the roof for fear that they were going to crush the waterway or damage the waterway because it was fixed, and there wasn't much room between the tip of the waterway and the tip of the aerial to get it to the roof. It almost looked like a circus with clowns trying to get them to do that. And it took a long period of time. I think one of the reasons that we gravitated towards the pinnable waterway were just the number of waterway repairs that were necessary because they would consistently get damaged in that manner. And I appreciate you bringing up the point about NIOSH. It's almost unprecedented that they would come up with that kind of an advisory that quick, within a month's time. They did a good job. They were on the ball trying to alert everybody, as we are, through this medium, to make sure that their waterways are pinned and that aerial safety is a must. And then, as you related, Tom, to the operator's manual and owner's manual, it's interesting to note that many places that I go, including the place I went to yesterday, where we were looking for the operator's manual and it wasn't even around. And although the truck was a 1989 and it's almost 20 years old, you would think that that information would be readily available. We wanted to look up some facts and figures on the truck that would have been contained in the operator's manual. And for our audience members that may not understand, there's certainly a differentiation between an operator's manual and an owner's manual. The owner's manual is full of a lot of techno jargon and is about five binders thick that you generally find in the corner of the chief's office somewhere. But the operator's manual is generally a manual of 20 or 30 or 40 pages, and in many cases now they're actually found and shipped on CDs so that you can make as many of them as you want, print them off a computer, and have them. And it really gives an overview of how the apparatus operates and some light maintenance and some maintenance checks that have to be done and some safety checks at periodic intervals to maintain a high degree of safety with that piece. And a lot of times as we go visit and teach in these different fire stations, that information is just simply not available. It was lost. It was never delivered with a rig, allegedly, or whatever, but it's just not around. So that's certainly another good point to make as far as the aerial apparatus. Tom, as we move on now, as far as the apparatus accidents, just several headlines. Three Maryland firefighters were injured in a rollover towards the end of this month. New Jersey fire captain remains on duty, even as he's serving a one-year prison term in Pennsylvania for a third drunk driving conviction. He's a career firefighter in New Jersey and got jammed up in Pennsylvania. Nebraska ambulance rolls over. In the city of Tulsa, they had a fire truck roll over during an intersection collision this month. In the state of Wisconsin, we had a commercial pumper tanker roll over. In the state of Georgia, we had an apparatus crash on May 17th. In Texas, in kind of an ironic twist, on May 15th, a responding Texas fire apparatus struck and critically injured one of Texas's most well-known personal injury attorneys. Geez, Tom, I wonder if there's going to be a lawsuit.
Geez, I don't know, Mike. Even if that attorney is somewhat incapacitated, I'll just bet he's got a couple of, I think, what do they call them, associates? Probably has some associates in his office already working on putting together the brief for how they're going to go sue that department. So I hope that department has the old proverbial good hands insurance, because it sounds like they might need it there.
Yes, sir. And as in most months, there seems to be, again, this month, a high propensity of drunk drivers striking fire apparatus along the nation's roadways. Again, just a word of caution. Please be careful as you operate along the nation's highways and byways. In the state of Virginia, an apparatus crash killed two civilians and injured the apparatus operator on May 26th at an intersection collision. A New York State fire chief was ejected in a single vehicle crash, obviously was not wearing seat belts, unfortunately, in that particular incident. And in yet another bizarre twist, a firefighter in his personal vehicle rear-ended an 81-year-old man that was pulling out of his driveway. Officials said the responder was driving at 65 miles an hour when he rear-ended the man, who was traveling at 10 miles an hour. The skid marks are still visible today, and they extend for almost 400 feet. The speed limit in this particular stretch of road was 25 miles an hour. Luckily, nobody was seriously hurt, but just another example of somebody being way out of control. The ends don't justify the means. You cannot go 40 miles an hour over the speed limit through residential streets for any reason, anytime, anywhere. We talked about this last month, where a fire boss up in the state of Washington was being charged with 4 fire crew deaths in a wildfire, and although it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with driving as far as the event, certainly when it comes to the court action that took place, it has everything to do with driving, and it's just another example that we are not immune from prosecution, and we are not immune from being charged and convicted. In this case, a fire boss reached a plea deal and pleaded to 4 misdemeanor in the crew deaths of those firefighters up in Washington. And finally, to wrap up here, Tom, probably the crash of certainly the month, probably the year, and certainly one that out of all the crashes and all the case studies that I've done over a decade and a half of doing emergency vehicle operators training and writing courses and writing articles, this is one for the ages, where a Quint apparatus in Ohio ran through a 4-way stop intersection that also had a red flashing light, struck a minivan, carried the minivan into a utility pole, and then carried the minivan and the utility pole almost a full city block down the road. Unfortunately, the driver of the vehicle, which was an older man, a grandfather, was killed. His grandson, about 3 years old, was ejected and found about 20 feet from the vehicle's dead out on the street. And in what could only be described as a truly sad and macabre twist, the female firefighter that was driving the apparatus later learned that 2 people that she had killed with the fire truck were actually her own relatives. They were distant cousins. And our hearts and prayers go out to all those involved, an extremely difficult situation there. And again, they were on their way to a working car fire. And you and I both know, Tom, from our years of experience with a modern-day car fire, as long as there are no exposures and no human lives involved, that it doesn't really matter whether we get there in 5 minutes or 5 days, we're certainly not going to seriously alter the outcome of that car fire. And yet this Quint apparatus was driving through, again, a 25-mile-an-hour zone, and it's been unconcluded yet how fast it was going, but obviously to run to a stop sign, pick up a minivan and a utility pole, and drag it almost a full city block, one would have to think that they were going extremely fast, extremely fast. And again, our prayers and hearts go out to all those involved. Extremely difficult situation that's going to play out for the days and weeks ahead.
Yeah, Mike, and I guess if there is any overriding theme with some of the incidents that you just ran down, and not surprising, it's been repeated innumerable times. If you stay seated and wear your seatbelt, no matter what kind of vehicle you're in, and if you drive in a reasonable, safe, and sane manner, I think your expression that I've heard you mention several times in your classes is with due regard, and do not find yourself in a situation where you come to where you're blowing through intersections, you stay seated and belted, and you stop and slow down at signal or traffic sign controlled intersections, you'll find yourself more often than not arriving there in one piece and arriving there safely. And, you know, what presents a true emergency, you know, maybe to that department with the number of runs that they do and the types of incidents they have that that a working car fire was a big deal. I'm sometimes at a loss for words and just sad beyond belief when you read the scenarios that go on there, to think that how could the brothers and sisters have put themselves in a position like that? It's truly tragic. At any rate, let's switch up gears here. We're going to see if we can get Mike and Tom to get into this a little bit. Some apparatus trends that have been going on, some a little bit recently, some have been going on for a while. And the first one has to do with just the physical size of apparatus, but specifically pumpers. And then the B part of this kind of plays into this. You know, what's better? You know, a smaller, short wheelbase pumper that's got the basic equipment and the big five, as I call it, minimum five pre-connected attack lines, a reasonable-sized water tank, supply hose, seats for an appropriate number of personnel, and your basic engine company equipment. You know, what's better, a rig like that or one of these monster, you know, do-it-all units, rescue pumpers with double high side compartments and ladders in the body or ladders through the tank or a hydraulic ladder rack, and it carries virtually a plethora of tools and equipment, and it's like a Home Depot on wheels. And before I ask Mike for his opinion, I just say it was this really kind of came home to me, and while it probably wasn't anything consciously that this department did, for the last couple of weeks I was out visiting some fire stations here up in the western New York area, and was in a station where they had an older engine that was basically stripped of equipment. It was a 1986 model, so it was not a four-door cab, but a very short wheelbase little rig at a 1250 pump, 750 tank, high side compartments on one side, exposed ladders, and it piqued my interest so much, I actually went back to the car, put my camera down, and broke out my tape measure, and this thing had a 170-inch wheelbase. The overall length of the vehicle was slightly over 28 feet. I mean, it was just a sweet little, you know, short wheelbase rig. Yeah, it doesn't meet today's standards, but it wasn't designed to since it was an 86 model. Well, the more recent engine that the department had in this station, again, built for a very nice unit, built from a very reputable manufacturer, four-door, you know, cab, raised roof, seating for eight, top mount pump, 750-gallon water tank, so it had the same size water tank, but a big double high-side rescue pumper-style body, and then the wheelbase on this thing was 215, 218 inches, and I thought to myself it was a pretty stark comparison to look at what 20 years plus have done to us with respect to the overall design of fire trucks. And that was the reason. So, Mike, what do you see? I mean, clearly there's a trend to put more on a single axle and six tires, but you think we're going in the right direction here, or you think that maybe we need to rethink our thoughts here?
Well, I think there's several factors, key factors, Tom, that are really playing into the design of the apparatus now. First off, this old idea that we need to be one bigger and better than the Joneses, and we just this proliferation of thinking has just made all of the apparatus just too big, point one. The second point is due to the lack of staffing, whether it's a career department or a volunteer department, many departments are trying to join units up, aka pumper tankers, tanker pumpers, rescue pumpers, hazmat pumpers, ALS pumpers, BLS pumpers, and trying to make them multifunctional to get a lot of equipment on the road with just one truck. And in fact, even in the ladder company business, we're finding some departments that are trying to join a rescue company and ladder company. One that we're very familiar with, Tom and I, is in the Eden Fire Department in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, that took a full-size tower ladder, a huge unit, and a rescue truck, and then melded them into a tractor-drawn aerial where half of it is a rescue truck and half of it has the ladder company accoutrement of tools. They did a great job with that rig, by the way, and that worked out to be a good thing. So I think the staffing plays an issue in it. And then I think the third point to be made is that our mission has changed. Back in the days when Tom and I broke into fire service, the first truck I ever drove was a 1947 Mack that had 300 gallons of water and had four compartments on it. And that was okay then. But now with fire departments being charged with extrication, auto extrication, hazardous materials mitigation, EMS runs and workers, and that even affected New York City pumpers, where there's now a whole compartment on board just to keep EMS gear sanitized and clean and safe and usable. So I think those are some of the salient issues. But on the other hand, it doesn't give anybody license to make a truck, Tom, that's so big that it doesn't fit the neighborhood or the jurisdiction where they have to get it around. And I think we have to get rid of this idea that bigger is better. And there's some things that, quite frankly, I'd like to see outlawed, and one of them is a raised roof cab. There's only one reason that you put a raised roof cab on a fire truck, and that's to stand up in it and get dressed. And we know that that's just not the right thing to do. It's not the safest thing to do, and according to the standard, it's actually illegal to do. So things like that go a long way into making the trucks bigger and longer. Top mount pump panels, one of your favorite pieces of the apparatus. You know, and I know that it adds somewhere between 18 and 24 inches of just overall wheelbase length on the vehicle for not really a lot of benefit in many cases. So it's things like that. Your thoughts on my comments?
Yeah, Mike, I think you hit the nail on the head with respect to the mission has changed in many departments. A lot of departments now in their mission statement, or if you happen to go visit their website, they refer to themselves as an all-hazards agency, you know. And we're just not the fire department anymore. So there's departments that are running, you know, ALS engine companies, and if you're running an older unit, the department that I was in recently, their ALS gear was, you know, kept seat-belted and strapped in unused seats inside the cab because the unit was never really designed to carry that kind of stuff. So the next time a department like that goes to purchase a new unit, they're looking to have an outfitted ALS cabinet, either interior or exterior of the vehicle. If you get departments that previously, before hydraulic extrication tools came in all different shapes and sizes, that equipment was pretty much relegated to the rescue truck or whatever vehicle delivered the heavy rescue service. Mike mentioned the Eden department down in Pennsylvania. There's a department that Mike and I are both familiar with that down from Bedford, Virginia, down in southwestern part of the state of Virginia, right off of Interstate 81, did an excellent job in designing, once again, a tractor-drawn ladder to replace a tractor-drawn ladder, but the new ladder truck had specific compartments dedicated to extrication equipment. When we take that extrication equipment and now want to put it on an engine company, we're now taking the better part of one whole compartment or a compartment and a half now dedicated to the motor, cutter, spreader, the rams, sufficient stabilization, ensuring equipment, step shocks to be able to do the job, and a lot of other ancillary stuff that isn't necessarily just strictly associated with fire suppression, but that we find ourselves wanting to carry. And I think you made the best point, Mike, is that it's okay to change the mission of what the vehicle needs to be to match the mission of the department and the challenges that we're that are before us. But it's still way too easy to design something that is oversized, and then once you buy it and get it into the community, you find out it's like, wow, we maybe made a mistake. We made it a little too big. So I guess to wrap up on this segment, the one thing you want to consider, much along the lines of what Mike and I have spoken about previously with respect to aerial apparatus design, if you're considering going from a ladder truck to a tower, you want to bring a vehicle of a similar physical size into your community and make sure that it gets around. And you probably want to do the same thing with the engine. If you're considering buying something significantly longer, more than 18 to 20 inches longer in wheelbase or overall length than the longest vehicle you've got in your department today, you want to bring a neighboring community's rig in or salesperson of the company you're considering and bring something like that into your community and make sure that it can get around, it can fit. Obviously, it needs to fit the fire station. Make sure it can get around in the community so you don't find yourself having a problem. And that goes to our second item. Certainly a trend with carrying more water, not specifically just going from a straight pumper to an engine tanker or a tank wagon type or a tender if you're out west, but pretty common that if the vehicle you had previously had a 500-gallon water tank, people would tend to specify a 750 tank. If you had a 750 tank before, now it's not uncommon for people to want to have a 1,000-gallon water tank. And in the semi-rural areas, there's clearly a trend that you see if people are replacing the 1,000-gallon water tank on a single-axle pumper. They want to put 1,250 or 1,500 gallons on there. And then the question comes, and this is what prompted this particular one. Mike, the other week, as a result of what I do at work, somebody sent in a wish list from a semi-rural fire department, and here was the description of the rig. Front bumper with a trash line, 8-person cab with a raised roof, top mount 1,750 GPM pump, 1,250-gallon water tank, double high side compartments, ladders through the water tank or in the body, and we need to keep. And the last thing was we need to keep the rig as short as possible. And I just had to laugh out loud. I said, well, if you were trying to keep the rig as short as possible, you put about 3 different things in the recipe that cause you to go in exactly the opposite direction. So I guess I need to get a handle on how, you know, what that department's definition of short was. If short is 36 feet, then you don't have a problem. If short was 32 feet, I don't think you're going to build a rig with an 8-person cab and a top mount pump and a 1,250-gallon water tank. And they then put in parentheses 1,500-gallon preferred, and to do all that on a single axle. So, Mike, what do you see? Does that increase water doing anything when you're going out to do the driver training? Do you see people giving you feedback on this, that if it was a good thing, bad thing, or how do they feel?
Well, I think the first thing that our listeners need to understand is that if they go in 3 departments in any given direction from their own and talk to firefighters in those departments, they will find a fire department with firefighters that have purchased a new apparatus within the last 3 years, and they absolutely hate it. Part of the reason could be a problem with the truck committee. Part of the reason could be a problem with the vendor, and part of the reason could be a combination of both. As far as the water, the propensity for rollovers in this business just continues to escalate at almost a scary rate. And certainly many of those are in tankers and pumper tankers that were not NFPA compliant, that were not properly baffled. In fact, I'm reviewing one such event for NIOSH as we speak in a tanker, a mobile water supply apparatus that was actually in its previous days a fuel truck. And they took a Peterbilt tractor with 800 and some thousand miles on it and put a fuel tank on it and then took it around a 90-degree turn, and the driver ended up being a fatality earlier this year. And it had 4 compartments with 3,000 gallons of water on the truck with no baffles. And so that becomes a big concern. And as you well know, with your work, people want all these things, and yet they want to keep it shorter. Well, if you have a lot of water on the truck and you want it shorter, then the water has to go up. And regardless of who builds the truck, it really doesn't matter. There tends to be a higher center of gravity with those apparatus, and they tend to have a higher propensity to flip over and roll over. The only other thing that can possibly be done with that water is to stretch it out, which elongates the truck, which makes it difficult to get around in many rural jurisdictions as well. And just looking through slides and doing some of the teaching that we do on the apparatus architect stuff and apparatus flaws, sometimes we take good ideas and combine them together, and it turns out to be a bad idea. Having a 2-door cab with a side-mounted pump is good. Having a 4-door cab with a side-mounted pump is good. Having a 4-door cab with a side-mounted pump is good. Having a 2-door cab with a top-mounted pump isn't necessarily bad. But having a 4-door cab with a top-mounted pump elongates the vehicle so much that we're having standard pumpers or pumper tankers on 168-inch wheelbases, or 268 rather. And so they're actually longer wheelbases than some aerial devices, And for a rural setting, it just doesn't seem to make any sense to me that it becomes, they just become behemoths and they're just so difficult to get around. And then we're not even talking about the bridge and weight restrictions, the single lane roads that are barely roads with the water gullies on either side that you can easily slip into and create a tragedy. Your thoughts, Tom?
You know, Mike, I guess there's maybe two different segments of this when we first laid it out to start talking about. One goes to the point you're talking about in the rural areas where clearly one of the missions of any suppression vehicle is to bring as much water as you can because there is no municipal water supply. And what I have seen from the industry side is that it's pretty common that when it comes time to replace an older unit, that whatever the water tank size on the prior unit was, and this is generally if we're in the 500 to 7 to 1,000 gallon tank capacity area, more often than not, departments instinctively, they just want to carry and bring more water with them. Well, I can tell you that from a body design standpoint, there is a significant difference in the center of gravity between a body design that has a 1,000-gallon water tank where you still need to carry a fair amount of supply line and some nominal attack lines or you know, some bulk non-pre-connected beds off the rear hose body, all right, and to be able to do that as compared to a body design where you want to carry 1,250 gallons of water. And the center of gravity goes up, as Mike says. I mean, the part of this is going to be addressed to a point with the new NFPA that it's has raised the awareness of the fact of the center of gravity issues with respect to some apparatus designs. And then it goes one step further. The brothers in the rural area will take a look at a more modern rescue engine, what Mike and I were just describing, a double high side body that has the ladders enclosed within the body in some fashion, whether in the tank, through the tank, alongside, between the tank and the body, no matter what. That cavity, if you've got a standard pumper complement of ladders, is going to be approximately 12 and a half to 15 inches wide. It needs to be 172 inches long times the height of the ladders. That cavity that you're taking for your ladders is now taking away from an area where the water would normally be. With once again, it causes the water tank level, the height of the tank, to go up, impacting the center of gravity. And very candidly, the way the marketplace is, there's very few manufacturers that are not going to offer something like that because that's what the market, that's where the market is going. Now, is it a practical design? Probably not. If you look at it, that the height from the ground to the bottom of the hose bed on some of these designs is well over 80 inches and sometimes well over 90 inches in the air. So, and then I think you have to take a look at the part where Mike plays into it, when you go to drive and operate and handle these pieces of apparatus. It's not uncommon for these things to be a little bit top-heavy, number one. Number two, while we can put, you know, a 525-horsepower motor in these things, so they will go and accelerate without any problem. Once you get into a 27,000-pound or a 31,000-pound rear axle, the physical size of the brakes on those axles doesn't change. Brakes don't get bigger just because you've got more water on there. If you've got 16.5 by 7-inch brakes on the rear on a Meritor RS series axle, the brake sizes don't change. The brake chambers might certainly are going to change and increase, but you're not doing anything to positively impact the braking and the handling characteristics of this. Again, you take this one step further. In my thought process, you put this in a smaller rural department where they don't run a lot. The roads may not be, as great as driving down a state highway or an interstate highway. I was in one community recently touring around with an assistant chief and commented that, you know, the road was literally two vehicles wide with the double yellow line down the side. And as compared to where Mike and I live in different parts of New York where there is a shoulder of the road that's nominally paved, most of these roads in this community is once you got off the hard pavement onto the shoulder of the road, you were into gravel grass or worse, or you were in a ditch. And these long vehicles that weigh a lot just don't lend themselves many times in the response mode to traveling down these highways. And we tend to, I think, might get a false sense of security because we're wrapped in that aluminum or steel envelope that we're safe when we're really not safe.
Well, that's true, Tom. And I think much to the manufacturer's credit, the trucks that they're building now aren't the old rattle traps that you and I first started out in. Many times the trucks that are being built now drive and handle better than the personal cars that firefighters drive to the firehouse to go man the apparatus. And so that just lends itself even more to a false sense of security. The thing drives and handles and rides better than anything that they've ever been in. But the reality is that it still has a 1,000-gallon tank, and with water over 8 pounds a gallon, that's 8,000 pounds of water weight in motion as they're trying to respond with these vehicles. One thing to mention, too, you touched on the NFPA with the tilt testing and the stability. They have also put speed restrictions on some of these trucks. Did you want to speak to that?
Yeah, that's... That's interesting that they're saying that for vehicles, I believe, that are in excess of 50,000-pound gross vehicle weight, the speed is going to be limited to 60 miles per hour or what the tires are rated for, the lower of the two, and that other apparatus is going to be speed limited to 65 miles per hour or the maximum speed rating on the tires, whichever is lower. I guess I'm going to play devil's advocate here. I mean, I've been in the apparatus industry, as most of our listeners know, for the better part of 28 years. I'm not an advocate of going, so fast that you can't control the apparatus. The maximum speed rating that is available on tires rated for emergency service now, at least from two of the major brands that I'm familiar with, Goodyear and Firestone, or Goodyear and Michelin, rather, are speed rated up to 75 miles per hour. There are certain areas of the country where the legal speed limit on interstate highways is 70 or 75. I know the NFPA is trying to look at this from an aspect of firefighter safety. However, I can tell you from personal firsthand experience in dealing with innumerable fire departments in a lot of different states that they're looking for these vehicles where they do a lot of interstate highway work to be able to get up to 60 or 70 or 72 miles an hour so they can get out and move along with traffic. So how that speed limit is going to play out, I think, it'll be interesting. That might be one of the things I would not be surprised to see some people take a pass on that particular one. I understand where the committee was coming from, but I've got very mixed feelings about how practical the application of that one is going to be.
Yeah, and I think just one last point here. I remember going to a couple meetings and actually getting into some, not necessarily arguments, but some strong discussion. The manufacturers continue to come up with ways to make these things bigger, faster, that can handle more weight. And I think we have to stop and realize that, particularly for the volunteer sector, where they may not drive heavy trucks all the time, we're outpacing the driver's ability to handle the vehicles that are being built. And they call that a training issue. Call it whatever issue that you want. The argument was over, well, we can put 2,100 gallons of water on a single axle. Well, yeah, that may be true that you can do that legally and safely, but what about the guy driving it? Can he actually handle 2,100 gallons of water on a single axle, only driving it, a few times a year? And I really believe that the manufacturing sector, again, is doing a really good job, almost too good, as it relates to putting these components together and just being able to carry more weight and carry it faster.
Very good point, Mike. And with that, we're going to take a break here for a couple of minutes and come back. You're listening to the Apparatus Architects at firehouse.com. Once again, we'd like to thank Task Force Tips for sponsoring the Apparatus Architect podcast series, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Help me out here. TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
Welcome back. It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Chan, the Apparatus Architects. If anyone has questions or anything they would like us to field or answer or just ponder about, please send them in to podcast@firehouse.com, and we'll be happy to entertain those on the air. We'd also like to announce that on July 26th, which is a Saturday, the Saturday of the Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland, we're going to be hosting a live podcast. As the time gets nearer, we'll give you an exact time during the course of the day when we're going to be doing that. There'll be a couple of other inside programs that Mike and I will be putting on. One is First Do Engine and Truck Operations. Another one is Designing Rescue Squad Apparatus. We'll hopefully also be doing another podcast with some apparatus manufacturers during the course of the expo. And on Saturday the 26th, at a time to be determined, we're going to be doing a live podcast. That means live. We need audience participation and folks there to come in and can bring their problems, questions, or burdens that they might have with respect to apparatus, and we'll do our very best to get those answered for you. So back on topic here, some apparatus trends, are they good or bad? Going to finish up here with one of the most favorite words that Brother Mike has in his whole vocabulary. He has a bright yellow baseball cap that proudly he wears when he goes to his son's soccer games that says, "I heart Quint's." And that question is, Quint apparatus versus straight ladder trucks or any or other aerial devices, a.k.a. things that don't have pumps and tanks on them. So briefly, Michael, your thoughts, because to me, this certainly is a trend and goes right along with the engine company apparatus getting bigger, heavier, bulkier, more water, more everything. Are we doing the right thing when we put a pump and a tank on a ladder truck? And let's please try to just keep this to 5,000 words or less.
For most people, Tom, the answer is an absolute no. I think it would be good of the listeners to ask themselves how many times they've used the pump on their Quint. That would be a good starting place. And we find that firefighters are putting pumps on trucks and tanks almost in fear, like they're going to show up, and if there's a fire, they may not be able to do anything. That's what they make engine companies for. And we're fighting this proliferation of pumps and tanks on aerial apparatus that really need portable ladders. And, of course, we only have so much room for so much stuff. And if we put pumps and tanks on it, on aerial apparatus, then we don't have enough room for a good complement of portable ladders. And, of course, we've spoke about it and written about it often, where the NFPA has just continually cut the complement of portable ladders to today's standard, where you only need 115 feet on an aerial ladder truck and you only need 85 feet on a Quint apparatus. Well, there's absolutely nobody out there that can properly portable ladder four sides of a 2.5-story private dwelling and ladder the roof with 85 feet of ground ladders, and that's what this ladder truck is supposed to be all about. So I think we're really foolhardy. And what we find out is when we put pumps on ladder trucks is that they become very expensive pumpers, because you know and I know that the front of thing to do in the fire service is to stretch a hose line and put a fire out. And so if you are riding in on a Quinn apparatus, there's an overwhelming propensity for people to do engine work and either do the truck work so late that it doesn't matter or to not do the truck work at all. And if it's your brother, sister, mother, cousin in this building, they'll probably end up being dead or seriously hurt by the time that we get to them. And that becomes another problem with Quince. And then finally, this work that we do, this firefighting, is hard enough riding on an engine or riding on a full truck and knowing that you're going to be an engine firefighter or knowing that you're going to be a truck firefighter. It almost seems very unsafe to me to put somebody on a Quint and have them show up at the scene of a fire and not know what they're going to do. And it's almost like, surprise, what are you going to do at this fire? And you and I both know that size-up starts when you receive the alarm. Well, how can you do a good size-up when you don't know whether you're going to be an engine company or whether you're going to be a truck company? And then finally, when you go to place the aerial part of the Quint, chances are pretty good you're going to be out of position for engine operations or for getting supplied with water. And then conversely, if you are in line to get water and do engine company operations, you're probably going to be out of position to use the aerial aggressively as far as rescue and ventilation and roof access. So it just, in the cases that I see, in a high percentage of time, 95 to 98% of the time, people that are buying Quints are absolutely wasting their money, and they're buying trucks that are very expensive engine companies, basically. Your thoughts?
Well, Mike, it's interesting. You gave us the firefighting perspective. I'll give you the industry perspective. Unfortunately, right, wrong, or indifferent, the most common aerial device being purchased and specified in our great country is a 75-foot single-axle rear-mount Quint. When you go to the different fire shows, if I look at, I've already been to six so far this year, most recently the major one, which is always a great time, down at the Harrisburg Fire Expo, put on by the Lancaster County Firemen's Association, but it's physically located in Harrisburg. If you look at the different vehicles that the manufacturers put on display, both units that have customers' names on the side versus stock units that are available for sale for immediate delivery, 99.5% of them have pumps and tanks on them. So to me, when you are the unsuspecting consumer, about to become, link up with one of these manufacturers, you see what's on display, and it reinforces that most ladder trucks have pumps on them. And we are probably in some cases preaching to the choir here, because I kind of sense with some of the listeners they've already divided up sides based on whether they're, pro putting a pump and tank on the unit or not. It is a major large city thing. If you look at it out on the West Coast, most of the major, many of the large cities out there, you take Los Angeles City, San Francisco, many of the Southern California cities, the ladder trucks tend to be straight conventional aerial devices. Very, very few tower ladders out there, a high proliferation of tractor-drawn ladders. Some people would argue it's an East Coast thing. There are no pumps and water tanks on FDNY ladder companies. Ditto up in Boston, in Baltimore, in Washington, D.C. You'd have to get to a community like Richmond, Virginia, that went to a total Quint concept, or the more infamous one out there, probably the city of St. Louis, that went to a total Quint concept. If you're going to do that, you're making a conscious decision that you're changing your operations up. And if you've never owned a ladder truck before, in some of the communities that Michael and I have done work for, if they've never owned a ladder truck before, our advice more often than not has been, even if they've got money falling out of their pockets, has been go buy a good used ladder truck of some type and find out what ladder truck work is about. These communities that never had an aerial device and then go out and buy an aerial Quint, a tower Quint, the biggest thing that they can fund or fit in the firehouse, generally never truly experience what ladder company service is all about. It occasionally happens, but more often than not, they just never experience it. And as Mike says, it becomes a giant tandem axle rig that has a pump and a tank and hose. And by the way, it has some ladders, generally not enough to do the job, and maybe a little bit of equipment. And the most often heard thing that we get as a pushback from people when they get our advice and tell them, don't put a pump and a tank on a vehicle, they'll be like, well, what happens if we come across a fire? Well, if you come across a fire with a ladder truck, you got a couple of cans, you're going to hold it, you're going to throw ladders, you're going to start doing an initial search, and you're going to wait for the engine guys to get up there and go do the work. Because if you had a pump and tank on the truck and then start going into fire suppression duties, in most cases, in a lot of these smaller communities, that is the ladder truck. Then there is nobody throwing ground ladders. There is nobody doing the search, and there is nobody doing the vent. So now you're just taking those guys that should be doing the truck work, and you've turned them into engine guys. At that point, probably you find yourself you don't have enough resources to properly be able to do the job. And that brings us to this question. Ponder this for a moment. I guess they used to say, ponder this, Batman. Does your training and operations change when you take delivery of a new apparatus in your department that's different from what you're replacing? So let's take, for example, you've got a 1970s vintage conventional midship mount 100-foot ladder truck. Your community got a fire act grant. You had some chicken barbecues. You did whatever you needed to do, and you are the now proud owner of this 105-foot rear mount aerial tower Quint. What changes in the department when you take delivery of that $850,000 monster? Mike, you go out just about every week when you're not working in the Bronx at Ladder 27, and you're out pressing the flesh, training people on safe operations from a driving perspective, or that together with aerial operations. How many times do you find, because I think it's earlier today you mentioned that if you go around and look at five or six new fire apparatus, chances are you find at least a couple of folks, after the honeymoon's over, they're not happy, they're not pleased with what they bought. How often do you find that people change up their operations once they get this new apparatus, no matter whether it's an engine or a truck, but for now we'll talk about the truck application, where it's significantly different from what they owned previously?
Almost never, and that's where part of the problem comes in. And a couple of points that we make when we're teaching. The first is God didn't put a 28 paved roadway around every building that you're going to have to take your aerial device to. And so the idea of taking them off the road has to be a real consideration if you're going to get any use out of these very expensive apparatus. And that's not to say that we're going to go off into the woods four-wheeling with a million-dollar ladder truck. But on the other hand, if you're going to get any use out of it and you feel that sidewalks or curbs are an operational impediment, you need to grow up and get over it. Otherwise, you're going to be pretty inept at using your truck. That's one part. The second part becomes engine operations. If you properly position an aerial device at most structural fires, most engine company apparatus out there are not able to position themselves and handle that operation properly. God put fires more than 250 or 300 feet away from pre-connected hose lines on pumpers. And the fire service needs to get over that now and start to change and adapt. Many times when you and I go out on fire protection studies, we're finding these McMansions that are being built that are 8, 10, 12, 14,000 square feet. Some of them are actually bigger and have a bigger fire load than some commercial structures. And they're set way off the roadway. They require the use of an aerial device, but yet there's not enough room in the driveway to get more than one apparatus. And so the engine has to stay out on the main roadway. And again, with the 250 or 300-foot pre-connect, they're short each and every time. And then they really kind of don't know what to do or how to handle it. Your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, there's, I think, a couple of combinations of things going on. Let's relegate this to talking about the smaller, you know, departments that are 1 to 4 stations in size. They get a new piece of apparatus. It gets assigned to one firehouse. The initial training gets completed by the manufacturer. If it's an aerial device, people feel somewhat confident that you know, they know how to operate the aerial. And I think that a lot of times just the newness, it kind of diminishes off very rapidly, Mike, in that they don't look at the unit and say, okay, well, hey, this rig is we replaced a single axle rig. This thing is now a tandem axle unit. We need to significantly step up the pace of training on our driving because the vehicle physically is bigger and longer. I was in a department that will go nameless here within the last couple of last 3 to 4 weeks where they had taken delivery of a new rescue vehicle, and the chief proudly proclaimed that the rescue vehicle was 3 feet longer than his ladder truck. And the first thing that struck me is, like, well, number one, I'm not sure why you needed to make your rescue vehicle 3 feet longer than your ladder, but more importantly, how much bigger and longer is it than the vehicle it replaced? I sure hope you've put everybody through a thorough driver training program, starting out with cones in a parking lot, to refamiliarize your drivers and your chauffeurs, your engineers, whatever you happen to call them, with this vehicle and the fact that it's physically bigger. Maybe even it has the same size axles. I don't know. Maybe it weighs the same. Give them the benefit of the doubt. The thing's bigger. It's longer than the ladder truck now. So what are we doing to ourselves? I think in many cases you talked about the manufacturers outpacing the ability of the fire department from a technological standpoint to design apparatus to bring components to the marketplace to make our job as firefighters easier and safer. That's great, but you take a combination of, and I'm not that I'm picking on these components, but these are two ones that I think that are relative to the make the point. Most engine companies now come equipped with some type of pump governor. Very rare that you see a relief valve, a manually operated relief valve. And many units have some, if not all, of the valves are electrically operated, and not that either one of those components in and of themselves are bad. But I've been in departments and witnessed, you know, simple evolutions on the drill yard where we've raised a generation of firefighters, Michael, that on engine company apparatus specifically, it's like point and shoot. These people are very good and very adept with hand-eye coordination because of being brought up in a different era than you and I were with respect to access to computers and video games and stuff like this. And it becomes the pump governor is like push two buttons and everything's supposed to work. But the day that something doesn't work because these things are electronic in nature and electronics occasionally fail or malfunction, even if it's momentary, we've not provided a training regimen for these people to back up their training to say, what do you do when this thing fails? Mike and I, for the last couple of years, have had the good fortune of going out to San Diego to instruct at the firehouse world program out there. And a number of years ago, we met a very nice captain that was in the training bureau whose job was to develop training materials for the new apparatus as they came in. And they actually had task books for each make and model of engine company and aerial apparatus that they had in their fleet, and you had to be proficient in going through and completing that. It was a multi-page document that you had to successfully go through and get checked off and approved and certified that you knew how to operate this vehicle. And some of the scenarios involved when a principal device on the vehicle didn't work, what you would do as an alternate, for example, to get a supply line, if you put the supply line in to your right side, pump intake, opened up the piston intake, relief valve, the PIV on that side, and nothing happened, what do you do? And I think in many cases, to go to your point you made earlier, the training that we've given the folks, we've gotten lulled into a sense of security that all this electronic stuff, it is just like a point-and-shoot fire world. You know, we push the button, the valve opens. We push this button and this button, and the pump governor is now activated, and it brings it up to a preset number, and everything else is supposed to be fine and dandy. And I'm not damning this equipment across the board, but I've just found a lot of departments that have, I don't think it was necessarily a conscious decision, but they've dumbed down the training to the point where there's very little remedial type activities going on. And I think that's, in some cases, why we are where we are in the fire service.
A point well made, Tom.
Yeah. So, you know, is there a specific answer to this? Yeah, probably not, other than the fact that when you receive and accept delivery of your new piece of apparatus, and this can go to take the newest rig you've got, it doesn't, you know, the statement I'm about to make doesn't mean you have to wait until you get a new fire truck. Take the newest piece of apparatus you've got and take everybody that is qualified to operate that unit, or if you happen to be in a career department, anybody that could drive that vehicle. And in a lot of departments, that's not a dedicated position. It used to be the senior person's job in some cases. Now it's the junior person's job because nobody wants the job because it doesn't necessarily pay any more money, or the department is structured in the fact that it's like the low man on the totem pole gets to drive today, is to take everybody on your crew, right, break out and locate that operator's manual, all right, and make sure that everybody knows every component on the vehicle, what it is, how it operates, how you have to maintain it, lubricate it, or otherwise use that, and then start to develop some practical scenarios based on your department's own SOGs to say, here's what we do, here's what we expect on a fire ground, on a street alarm assignment. We expect, for example, some simple basic things. The engine to pull past the building to leave room for the truck. We expect, here's the different lengths of attack lines that we have. Here are the required pump pressures to pump these different lines based on the lengths, the nozzle configuration that you have, and the gallon per minute flow that you hope to achieve through each of those lines. And develop some practical scenarios that people can practice what you're going to do, and then start to throw some wrinkles in that there would be practical impediments that, for example, you laid a line from a supply line from that, from a hydrant, but the hydrant's not operable. What do you do? What's the department procedures for what you do if you happen to catch a bad hydrant? Or if you catch a hydrant and it works, but you have inadequate water. It's interesting that within the last couple of days there was a multi-million-dollar fire. They haven't even attached a dollar figure to it out at Universal Studios in Los Angeles, which was fought by a combination of resources from, at the very least, Los Angeles County and the Los Angeles City Fire Departments, and I'm sure many other organizations as well. It just got posted up on Firehouse this morning that one of the probably innumerable hurdles that the departments had to face for the size and massiveness of that fire, which was over three blocks in length, was inadequate water supply. Well, what's your department do? There's got to be some areas in your community that doesn't have adequate water supply with respect to the hazards that you have in your community. What are you going to do there? Just shrug your shoulders and burn the building down and admit, geez, we didn't have good water here? Now, we're supposed to be able to be able to move water and overcome some of these obstacles. So those are some of the things we need to think about. So we're going to finish up today by just having a brief little commentary on, does your department have an apparatus replacement program? And this is more than just a yes or no response, right? If you own even a single fire truck, you need to have a replacement plan figured out for at what point you're going to be able to financially afford to go encumber the funds to replace that vehicle. There are, I can assure you, many large departments that don't have a written, well-thought-out, developed apparatus replacement plan because they've had to rely upon politicians or other folks outside of the fire company organization to determine from a budgetary standpoint, we're going to give you X amount of money so this year you can go buy a fire truck. But for the next 5 years, we're not going to have money, so you're not going to be able to buy a fire truck. Apparatus certainly isn't getting any lesser expensive. The impact of the NFPA changes for 2008, which will take effect for any contract signed after January of 2009, together with not too far around the corner, the 2010 engine emissions, which are radically going to change the marketplace and the cost of apparatus with diesel engines, makes it incumbent upon any organization to have a well-developed, thought-out plan. And that might be the premise for some of our listeners, that if they have questions or have a scenario in their community and say, here's what we own, you know, to get if this is what we've got and here are the years, here are the ages and makes, and here's the mileage on them, you need to look at some of the repair history cost and the usage factors on these vehicles. If you don't have a plan now, you've got some time to be able to put something into place before you find yourself that after 2010, when the next round of EPA regulations take impact on fire apparatus, to find out that, unfortunately, and not that I'm predicting this through the crystal ball, but I don't think it's too much of a stretch to find out that some of these smaller to medium-sized fire departments are going to find themselves that buying any kind of new fire truck, even commercial chassis, is in a lot of cases simply going to be beyond their financial means to pull off, where they're not tax supported. And if you don't have a plan, it's time to start thinking about it and getting one in place before you wait for a vehicle to undergo an annual service test and find out it doesn't pass, or even worse yet, an aerial ladder to find out that it squeaked by its last non-destructive testing certification. And now this year, the testing company recommends that you pull the thing out of service, and you find yourself staring at a, you know, 22-year-old ladder truck that's not worth sinking any money into it, and you never had any plan for putting money away or for what at what point you were going to replace the vehicle. So, Mike, I know you see a lot of different departments. You get to see a lot more iron on the street than do I. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I just relate one story. I went to a place out in the Pacific Northwest, and the chief claimed he had an apparatus replacement plan. My original charge was to go out there and do an aerial needs assessment. And the chief had bought two mini pumpers, and this is a four-station department, bought two mini pumpers new that, as you and I know, really don't account for much of anything, and then had three mobile water supply trucks that were re-chassied with tanks that were made by a local outfitter that didn't even have dump valves on them. And the newest pumper in the fleet, or some of the older pumpers in the fleet that were still first run, were in the late 80s. And they're telling me that they have an apparatus replacement plan. As much as I hate to admit it, being the true truck person that you know me to be, engine company apparatus are the absolute rock of the fleet. And if the newest pumper in your fleet is more than 10 years old in a four-station operation, and you're riding around, your crews are riding around in late 80s C-model open cab Ford open jump seat bench seats, that in my world is the problem. And then you tell me you have an apparatus replacement plan, and you're buying some of the stuff you're buying and allowing firefighters to ride out on some of the other stuff, and I just question that logic. So even people that think that they may have an apparatus replacement plan simply do not. And the reality is, with the cost of apparatus escalating at the rate that you just described, and what's going to occur over the next couple of years as far as price increases, fire trucks, with the exception of fire stations, represent the biggest capital expenditure that fire departments can make. And to not have that pre-programmed and pre-planned out in this day and age is just foolhardy at the very best. The days of going into the city council or the town council or the governing body and saying, you know, my pumper's got a little rust on it and I think we need to get a new one next year, those days are gone for good now. There's just too much money involved, and these trucks are just too expensive to expect to go into the city fathers and ask for $500,000 for a pump or $1 million for a ladder truck from one year to the next and think that it's going to go and it's going to fly. That's just not the case. You know, we just can't urge our listeners enough to develop it yourself, get help from people like us or somebody like us that can come in with perhaps a fresh set of eyes and look over your operation and come up with some kind of legitimate replacement plan so that you don't break the bank and we don't get the community or the politicians mad at us for wanting too much too soon that it's just too expensive.
I think good point, Mike. Some folks think they have a plan or will tell you they have one, and then when you look at it, it's a plan. Maybe it wasn't completely developed or completely thought out. But so, you know, that's bad, but even worse than that is having no plan whatsoever. You know, to finish up, it's with all the things coming down the pike with respect to NFPA standards, governmental regulations, the impact of inflation on the cost of fire apparatus, whereas in the past apparatus cost went up, you know, somewhere between 3 to 4, maybe 4.5% a year. It certainly looks like it's going to max out over that cap. And even if you had a developed plan and were putting away X amount of money per year in a capital reserve account or had a solid block of money that had to be voted on in a public setting to go buy your fire truck, if you're going to wait an additional 7 or 8 months to go make that purchase, you may find out that original cash of money that you had is not going to be adequate to meet your needs for what you had planned on purchasing. So, unfortunately, to wrap up, you know, time is not our friend in this particular case. Time is our enemy with respect to the impact of all those other outside forces of what is going on here with respect to apparatus. So even if you've got, for our listeners, a developed plan, something that you perceive was well thought out and had a lot of good thought process behind it, still might be like that ill-found operating manual that Mike was looking for, you know, for the 89 ladder truck. Might be kind of, you know, remove that from the chief's file, blow the dust off it, let's take a fresh look at it and make sure that it's still going to be valid to accomplish what we want to do. So wrapping up to the apparatus architects, Michael Wilbur and Tom Shand, we thank you very much for listening to us on this segment. We look forward to seeing everybody at the upcoming shows and particularly at Firehouse in July. And once again, we'd like to thank Task Force Tips for being the very kind sponsor to sponsor Michael and Tom for the apparatus architect. So until next time, please, everybody, travel and be safe. And remember, seated and belted is the only way to go when responding and returning from alarms. So thank you all, and we'll pick you up on the next time.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.